Thank you, David. To take a quote from Stephen Hawking, can you hear me? Yes.
Can okay. You turn it on?
Okay. I did turn it on, and it's all right. Sound is coming through all right? Yeah. Okay. I would like to set the stage for speculating about the 21st century by beginning with a overview of the two great revolutions that came to us in terms of our understanding of the laws that govern the universe, the two great revolutions that came in the 20th century. The first of these revolutions was due almost single-handedly to Albert Einstein in the period between 1905 and 1915. And Einstein told us that space and time are warped by the matter and energy that flow through space-time, and that this warpage is responsible for gravity. This is a remarkable prediction that Einstein made. It was made on the basis of almost no experimental evidence, but rather it was made on the basis of an insistence that all the laws of physics should hang together in a self-consistent manner, and this drove him toward the conclusion of the warpage of space and time. Technology only became capable of doing high-precision tests of Einstein's prediction some 60 or 50 years later. The prediction that time is warped by the presence of matter told us in particular that if you go up to a height very high above the surface of the Earth, that time will be flowing more rapidly because time slows near the surface of the Earth or near the surface of any other massive body. And so on June 18, 1976, Bob Vesseaux from the Harvard Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, with the help of NASA, flew a set of atomic clocks in a suborbital flight to a height of 10,000 kilometers, something like 1.5 Earth radii. And up to a height where at which time should flow, according to Einstein's laws, more rapidly by about 4 parts in 10 billion than down on the surface of the Earth. Signals were telemetered back down to the Earth, and thereby the ticking rate of the clocks in the suborbital flight in this rocket was compared to the ticking rate of atomic clocks down at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And the prediction was then that there should be a slowing down of time on the Earth to an accuracy at a level of about 1 second each 1,000 years, and that corresponds to the 4 parts in 10 billion. The clock's accuracy was good to about 3 parts in 100 trillion, 3 parts in 10 to the 14, and so in fact the prediction was borne out with the precision of the clocks, and it was confirmed to a part in 10,000 accuracy that time is indeed slowed near the surface of the Earth compared to what it is out in interplanetary space. Einstein also predicted the warpage of space, and we can understand the warpage of space, say, for example, around the Sun, by thinking about the following thought experiment. We take the Sun and we pass through the equator of the Sun a sheet that precisely bisects the Sun between the upper half and the lower half. And you might expect that the geometry of that sheet would be Euclidean. It would be like the geometry of a flat sheet of paper here. But in fact, if you pull that sheet out from the interior of the Sun and take it out into interstellar space, insisting that the shape of the sheet be maintained unchanged, you discover that the sheet has a shape that looks like this. It has to bend around in interstellar space where space is flat. Up in here, it just bisects the Sun because space is curved. But by looking at the geometry of that sheet, we can see what then the geometry of space looks like inside the Sun. And what we find, in fact, is that the circumference around the Sun is less than pi times the diameter through the Sun, less by something like 10 kilometers or so. So that was a remarkable prediction that Einstein made. Again, it was possible to test this prediction only in the 1970s to high precision. November 26, 1976, in this case, Irwin Shapiro and colleagues at the time Irwin was at MIT, in collaboration with people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and with NASA, sent signals out, radio signals out from the Earth to the Viking spacecraft, which at that time were in orbit around Mars, one of them, and the other was on the surface of Mars. The spacecraft transponded the signals back, basically received them, boosted them up in power, amplified them, and then sent them back. And these radio signals had coded on them, a digital code. And so it was possible then to measure the round-trip travel time of the radio signals based on how long it took for a bit of the digital code to go out and to come back. During the experiment, Mars was moving around almost behind the Sun, relative as seen from Earth, and so as it moved, the signal went deeper and deeper into the curved space around the Sun. It was possible from the knowledge of the circumference of the orbits to predict just how far that signal should have had to travel to go out and to come back. Einstein's laws insisted that the signal always travels at precisely the speed of light, and so if it takes longer than you would expect based on a flat Euclidean geometry, then it must be because space is curved in here. And in fact, then, the prediction was that at the time when Mars came closest to being behind the Sun, or it came closest to the edge of the Sun as seen from Earth, that there should be an extra distance traveled of 37 kilometers. That's 37 kilometers out of a total distance of 378 million kilometers. The accuracy of the experiment was 37 meters, a rather good accuracy, less than a football field accuracy between here and Mars. And in fact, the prediction was borne out with the accuracy of the experiment to a part 1,000. It was confirmed that space is curved near the Sun by the Sun's mass in just the manner that Einstein predicted. Now, Einstein's laws also make another prediction about the warpage of space and time. They predict that there should exist in the universe objects in which the warpage of space and time are much more extreme than around the surface of the Earth. And I've brought one of those objects with me here today. This object looks like it's made from rubber. It's not really made from rubber. It's made from, at least if you'll bear with me, if it really were a black hole, it would be made, in fact, from a pure warpage of space and time and nothing else. You look at that object and you say, well, this has a circumference of about 3 feet. And so according to Euclid, it should have a diameter through the center that should be 3 feet divided by pi, or about 1 foot. But in fact, the diameter through the center is more like a mile. And you ask, how is it possible to have something that has a circumference of about 3 feet and diameter of a mile? And the answer is, space is highly warped in this object. In fact, this object is made from a warpage of space. We can understand it by the following thought experiment. Suppose that I have a rubber membrane. It might be a child's trampoline, for example. And I stick it up on poles high up in the air, and then I put a rock right in the center. And suppose that I'm an ant, and I live on this membrane, or on this rubber sheet, and that's my entire universe. Let's suppose I'm a blind ant, so I can't see across here to see that, in fact, there is an external third dimension to the universe. As far as I'm concerned, the universe has only two spatial dimensions, the surface of the membrane that I can feel as a blind ant. I'm a curious ant, and so I go to explore the geometry of my universe, and I measure a circumference around here by marching around and see that I have a circumference that something like 5 feet. And then I go to measure the diameter, and I expect the diameter should be 5 feet divided by pi, and so it should be something like 2 feet. But I go marching and marching and marching, and it's a very long trek, and I finally get to the other side, and I find that I've marched for a distance of a mile. And of course, the reason is because the space is in fact, the space of my universe, in fact, is warped very highly compared in the surrounding three-dimensional space that I cannot explore, that is not anything that is really part of my own universe. Well, similarly, we can think of our universe as a warped universe that lives in a higher dimensional space that is flat, which is sometimes called hyperspace. And we can think then of the geometry of space around a black hole as being then a warped geometry, a warpage with respect to the higher dimensional flat hyperspace. Down at the center of the trampoline, in my little analogy, there is this rock. And down at the center of the black hole, there is an object that I will talk about a little bit later called a singularity. Now, the warpage of space is not the only peculiar aspect of what's going on around a black hole. There is also a warpage of time. Time is slowed as I get deeper and deeper into the region of warped space. And ultimately, I come to a location that is called the horizon, or surface of the black hole. And just inside there, time is so badly warped that, in fact, it flows in what you would have thought was a spatial direction. Time flows downward. And so if I go into the black hole, sending a signal out to you by means of a microwave antenna, transmitting a signal out to you, and I'm a two-dimensional being now, I live on the two-dimensional surface of this diagram. The third dimension out here is really hyperspace. And as I go down into the black hole and go through this horizon, I come into the region where time, the future direction of time, is downward. And I, by the laws of physics, am forced always to move forward in time. And the radio signals that I'm trying to send out, or the microwave signals that I'm trying to send out to you, are also forced to always move forward in time. And moving forward in time means moving downward toward this singularity at the center. And that means that once I'm in here, there's no way I can come back out through the horizon. There's no way I can send any signals back out through the horizon. I and my signals are forced to move forward in time, and so we are dragged inexorably into the singularity. And thus the horizon really is a horizon. It is a location beyond which we on the outside can't see. There's no way at all for you on the outside to know what has happened to me once I've gone through the horizon, because time is so warped down inside. There is yet another feature of the warpage of space-time around black holes that I will talk about a little later, and that is that the black hole can be spinning, and that spinning can create a tornado-type motion of space in the vicinity of the horizon, which in fact will be very important for our future observations of black hole phenomena. But I will return to that in a bit. Now, we here on Earth would like to study black holes observationally. We are confined by our technology to remain outside the horizons of black holes, because there aren't any black holes in the solar system, and our current technology can't get us outside the solar system. We're also confined to stay outside the surface of black holes because we like to publish the results of our observations, and we can't publish if we go inside. And we can't get any information from the inside, and so for a little while I'm going to cut the black hole off at the horizon in these diagrams and talk only about the exterior of the black hole and the warpage of space-time beyond, outside the horizon where we can see. Now, this region outside the horizon may not be as interesting as the region inside, but it's still a very interesting region, and we would like to be able observationally to test Einstein's theory's predictions about black holes. And so astronomers have worked very hard over the last three decades or so using all kinds of telescopes that they've been able to build, optical telescopes, X-ray and gamma-ray telescopes, radio telescopes, studying objects in the universe that look like they may have black holes in them. This has been a very frustrating study, in that we have not yet gotten to a point where we can actually do detailed measurements of the warpage of space-time around an object that we think is a black hole. But nevertheless, we as astronomers, astrophysicists, have found very compelling evidence that black holes do exist, and they play very important roles astrophysically in the universe. And one of these programs that's going on at the ITP at the present time that David talked about is a program designed to develop a much deeper understanding of these black holes that we believe are being studied observationally. An artist's conception of something like I think is going on with black holes that are observed electromagnetically is that you have a black hole with a swirling cloud of gas around it in the form of a disk. This gas may come from a star that has been torn apart by coming too close to the black hole. It hasn't gone inside the horizon, but it got close to the black hole and got torn apart by the warpage of space and time near the black hole. And you have a huge amount of gas swirling around and around. And we see electromagnetic radiation coming off of this gas. We see jets coming off from what we believe are the north and south poles of the black hole, not emerging from the black hole itself, but emerging and produced as a result of interaction between the gas and electromagnetic fields interacting with this spinning black hole. And so we have a lot of detailed information about how black holes behave and what they do to surrounding gas and surrounding electromagnetic fields, a lot of rich astronomical observations, but these observations are not yet clean enough for us to be able, for example, to build a map, a detailed map of the space-time warpage around a black hole and see whether or not Einstein's predictions about that warpage are correct. And so I would now like to begin looking toward the future and speculating on what we will be seeing in the early part of the 21st century in terms of being able to test Einstein's predictions or the predictions of Einstein's theory about black holes. And I should perhaps back up and make a remark when I say Einstein's predictions. Einstein, in fact, resisted with great vigor the concept of a black hole. Even though black holes were predicted by his laws of general relativity, he wrote a classic paper in the 1930s saying that these things can't really exist in the universe. And he gave what for him were very strong arguments that in hindsight, decades later, we can look at and say those arguments were flawed. He was wrong. But it wasn't completely obvious. It wasn't at all obvious at the time. I think the majority of physicists in the 1930s were not willing to take black holes seriously any more than Einstein was. It has taken decades for physicists to come to the point where they really, and astronomers, where they really accept black holes as a firm prediction and where we really are beginning to do observational studies of them. So looking toward the future, what kinds of observations are likely to enable us to explore the details of black holes, the detailed space-time warpage around black holes? Well, suppose that out in the distant universe there is, and I don't need to suppose, we're essentially sure there are, say, two black holes orbiting around each other. In this case, a small black hole about the size of Santa Barbara that is orbiting around a large black hole about the size of Los Angeles, with a separation that may be a little larger than that, something more like the length of the state of California. The small black hole will be moving at nearly the speed of light around the big black hole, and so it will go around and around with many revolutions per second. And as it goes around and around, its warpage of space will create ripples in the fabric of space in much the same manner as if you were to stick your finger in a pond and stir your finger around and around, you create waves on the surface of the pond going out. So we see here these waves in the fabric of space that are waves of warpage or curvature of space traveling out from this black hole binary system. And as the small black hole spirals into this large black hole, it will generate these waves, which are called gravitational waves, by the way, because gravity, as I said before, is associated with the warpage of space and time. These gravitational waves will carry off, we now know, encoded in themselves, a detailed map of the space-time curvature around of the big black hole, which the small black hole is sampling as the small black hole spirals in. And so we have a dream, a plan, in fact, and instruments under construction that are aimed to be able to monitor these passing waves after they have left that black hole binary system out at the very, very far beyond our own galaxy, these two black holes are likely to be off at something like a third or a tenth the distance to the edge of the observable universe. And these waves have been created by this system that's the size of California, with the two objects the size of Santa Barbara and Los Angeles. These waves have traveled through the great reaches of intergalactic space, have come into our galaxy, and then through our solar system. As they go through our solar system, these instruments, which are under construction, will monitor the waves as they go by, decode the signals or the information that's in the waves, and from that decoding, we hope and expect to be able to build a map of the space-time warpage around the big black hole that was being sampled by the little black hole as the little black hole spiraled in. These instruments, the first generation of them, the first instruments of these type that will go into operation, are called the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO, which consists of two such instruments, one in Livingston, Louisiana, the other in Hanford, Washington. And then there's a third instrument in an international network. It's in Pisa, Italy. It's called Virgo, named after the Virgo cluster of galaxies beyond which these instruments are designed to reach. These instruments then are intended to measure the ripples in the warpage of space and time that make up the gravitational waves as the waves go through the solar system and through the Earth. How is this done? Well, you can imagine by analogy where you stuck your finger into a pond and stirred it around and around. You can imagine trying to monitor the ripples on the surface of the pond as they go by putting two corks on the surface of the pond and using a laser beam to measure the distance between those two corks. And as the waves go by, the corks will move back and forth relative to each other. As anybody who's been out in the surf here in Santa Barbara knows, you get pushed back and forth toward the shore in a way, as well as up and down as the waves go by. And so we monitor the passing gravitational waves by monitoring the distance between those two corks using a laser beam, which is a superb way to monitor distances, as any surveyor knows. Now let me describe the experimental challenge of doing this. The technique that is to be used, more precisely, is one in which four corks that are really made out of fused silica, that is out of quartz, they are moved back and forth by ripples in the warpage, ripples of warpage in the fabric of space. As the waves go by, space stretches along this direction and squeezes along that direction, and so these two corks in the form of these quartz cylinders get pushed apart, and those get pushed together. The next half cycle of oscillation of the waves, these get pushed apart and those get pushed together. And so a ideal technique for monitoring then the changing difference in arm length along these two directions is a technique called laser interferometry, in which a laser beam comes in, it goes through a beam slitter, light goes down this arm and down this arm, bounces back and forth a number of times, comes back and gets recombined at the beam splitter, and light goes into a photodiode photodetector. And basically you get an electrical current out of this photodetector that is directly proportional to and oscillates in a manner that's proportional to the passing gravitational waves. So that's the basic technique to be used. Now, let me give you some numbers that describe the experimental challenge. We are trying to detect very weak gravitational waves, waves that will change the separation between these quartz cylinders by about a part in 10 to the 21. These cylinders, by the way, are hanging by wires in the initial version of this instrument. Later they'll be hanging by fused silica or quartz fibers. They have a mass of 11 kilograms, so their sizes are about like this in diameter and about that in thickness. And they hang from about a 1 meter long wire. The gravitational waves are oscillating back and forth about 1,000 or 100 times per second. So although this looks like a pendulum would swing once per second. And so you know it's a gravitational wave and not just a normal pendulum swinging because it's moving back and forth so fast. Now the challenge is to measure fractional changes in the distance between those quartz cylinders at a level of a part in 10 to the 21. So let's look at some numbers. Let me back up and talk about this the way it really happened. Back in the 1970s, I and a handful of other theorists who were thinking about gravitational waves went to our experimental colleagues and we started talking with them in a dialogue. And started thinking about what would be required in order to detect these waves. And so you can ask your experimental colleagues, as we did, how accurately can you monitor the changes in separation between two objects that are very far apart? And some experimenters might say, well, I think I can do it at a level of about a tenth of a millimeter. That's the thickness of a human hair. And so then we can put that number into delta L and 10 to the minus 21 into the ratio and figure out how long L has to be, and the answer is about 3 light years. And that's not very practical. And so you then go and talk to another experimenter who's more clever, and this other experimenter says, I think I can do it to the diameter of an atomic nucleus, not to the diameter of an atom, but 100,000 times smaller than an atomic nucleus. And so then you can put that into the formula and see how long these arms have to be, and the answer is 4,000 kilometers. Well, that's getting a little more practical, but not really very, not with the kinds of budgets that we have to think about seriously. So you go talk to a more clever experimenter still, and the bottom line was that, in fact, the person who really did the pioneer thinking about this experimentally, Ray Weiss at MIT, figured that ultimately one ought to be able to get down to something like 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, 1,000th the diameter of the nucleus of an atom. And that means you need an arm length of a few kilometers. And so that's where we are. We're working on building instruments of this sort with arm lengths of 4 kilometers in a project that Ray Weiss at MIT, Ron Drever, and I started in the early 1980s that is now directed by Barry Barish at Caltech. And this is a picture of one of the two LIGO sites as it was about a year ago. These are long vacuum pipes inside which the laser beams go in order to have them be undisturbed by the Earth's atmosphere. The construction of the vacuum pipes and all of the buildings and all of the complicated vacuum system has been completed as of a few months ago. And the experimental team led by Barish is now mounting these instruments called gravity wave interferometers in those vacuum systems, aiming to begin taking scientific data in November 2001, so 2.5 years from now. So we're on the way, thanks to you and all of our other taxpayer friends. This is funded by the National Science Foundation and is viewed, I think, by many of us and many in the National Science Foundation as one of the most exciting things that's going on in science in the coming decade.
Where are the quarks in those?
So where are the quarks?
In those tubes.
So the quarks are at the ends of the tubes. Down inside this building, these quarks, which are really quartz cylinders hanging from overhead support, there is one here and one 4 kilometers away down there. There's another one here and 4 kilometers away down at that end.
Right.
And the laser beam is going back and forth down the tubes. I could give a whole lecture on this project. It's a fascinating project, but I want to move on to other issues in a moment. But let me just say a little bit about the interesting things that we expect to see in this project. We expect to see and be able to begin to map the warpage of space and time produced by a black hole or from which a black hole is made. And that warpage, as I mentioned in words before, includes a vortex-like motion, a spinning motion of space near the horizon of the black hole, which is very much like the spinning motion of air near the core of a tornado. And this is called the dragging of inertial frames. It's a dragging of space is a better way, I think, to think about it than talking about the fancy phrase inertial frames. But one manifestation of it, for example, is that if we have our big black hole and our little black hole, and the little black hole is in orbit that is inclined to the equatorial plane of the big black hole, the big black hole is spinning, the spin of the big black hole drag space into this tornado-like motion, and naturally then that space drags the orbit, and the orbit precesses around and around while the small black hole is moving in its orbit. And so we expect a gravitational wave oscillation that will look like this, with every time the small black hole goes around the big black hole, you have one little oscillation. And every time the orbit has precessed once, you get one big oscillation of the envelope. And so this indicates how there can be, in fact, encoded in these waves very detailed information about what's going on with the black hole, about the space-time warpage. Much more interesting to me, actually, is something where we don't know what happens, and that is when you have two black holes that have about the same mass, they weigh about the same amount, they have about the same sizes, and they're both spinning. So you imagine two tornadoes spinning about different axes, orbiting around each other, and the orbital motion has a lot of energy, or really a lot of angular momentum in it, and that angular momentum of orbital motion also drags space. So you have two tornadoes enveloped in a larger tornado coming crashing together and merging with violent oscillations of the material from which the tornadoes are made, that material being a warpage of space and time. We don't know what happens when these black holes collide with these violent whirling motions of space around them. There is a big effort in what is called numerical relativity, computer simulations, to compute what happens, to compute the waveforms that will come off that we then will measure with LIGO. But I have a bet with the leader of that effort that LIGO will see these things before the supercomputer simulations succeed in getting results. And I unfortunately expect to win this bet, because the computer simulations are every bit as hard at this stage as the experiment is, given how much effort has been put into the experiment and much less so far in the computer simulations. We expect then in the next decade to be going back and forth between computer simulations and the observations, trying to figure out how does space-time warpage behave in these violent circumstances. Now, black holes are just one of a number of objects that might populate what I like to call the dark side of the universe. By the dark side of the universe, I mean that piece of the universe that emits little or no electromagnetic radiation. A number of other objects that have been speculated upon that might populate the dark side of the universe are cracks in the fabric of space. These can take a number of different forms. There are linear cracks that are called cosmic strings. They are defects in space in the sense that the circumference around a cosmic string is less than 2 pi times its radius, and that's true all the way down. As you go closer and closer to the string, it just remains true. It has a geometry rather like the point of a cone in that sense. And this string, these cosmic strings vibrate. At the speed of light, they vibrate up and down, back and forth, and as they vibrate, they emit gravitational waves, according to the theory. We don't know whether there are any cosmic strings in the universe. If there are, we don't know how many, but it is quite plausible that a lot of cosmic strings were created in the very early universe by what are called phase transitions in the very early universe. And the best way, in fact, to search for evidence of them is to search for the gravitational waves that they would have produced. There are also maybe surface cracks in the geometry of space. Two-dimensional surfaces with a peculiar property that if you look at this surface from this side, you see it's curved toward yourself. Then you go around and you look at it from that side, and you see it's curved toward yourself on this side. Then you go in and you measure the thickness through it, and there's no thickness at all. It's infinitesimally thin. And then you say, how is that possible that it's curved this way as seen from that side, it's curved this way as seen from this side, and yet it's infinitesimally thin? The answer is it's a defect in the geometry of space. And when these defects in the geometry of space collide with each other in the early universe, in what is a possible product of what are called phase transitions in the early universe, they should produce very strong gravitational waves, which LIGO and other future gravitational wave detectors that I don't have time to discuss will search for. There also could be, conceivably, as I will describe in a few moments, singularities in the structure of space that would also emit gravitational waves. So there are a number of conceivable objects that could populate the dark side of the universe emitting gravitational waves. Black holes are the only ones we are sure are out there, but there are a number of other possibilities. Let me now turn for a little while to the second great revolution in the 20th century in our understanding of the laws that govern the universe. This was the quantum mechanical revolution. It began in the 1920s and is still underway. Quantum mechanics are the set of laws that we think of as governing the realm of atoms and subatomic particles. And I want to focus in on one of the peculiar aspects of quantum mechanics, just one. Suppose that you have an atom. The atom has a size that is huge compared to the accuracies with which we're going to measure, with which the experimenters in LIGO are measuring these motions of these cylinders. It has a size of 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. That's still extremely small, 10,000 times smaller than the wavelength of the light that we normally deal with. Suppose now, knowing that the size of the atom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, we decide we're going to measure where it is. And so we measure where the atom is and find it is right here. And then we decide we want to follow its motion thereafter. And you might have thought, well, knowing where it is and how its speed it started off with, you could just follow its motion and always following the motion to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. But in fact, that is impossible. The laws of quantum mechanics contain a particular law that is called the uncertainty principle, which says that the more accurately you measure where a particle is, the more uncertain its position will be afterwards. And that as you go on, its position becomes more and more uncertain. The very act of measuring the particle's location causes the particle thereafter to behave like a wave. A wave of what? A wave of probability. So that 1 second later, you can simply not predict where the particle is. You can't predict that it's going to be where you saw it before. You can't predict where it is to within an accuracy of about 1 kilometer. The so-called wave function of this particle is spread out over an entire kilometer. The particle has become a sort of a quantum fuzzball spread out over a whole kilometer. And even in principle, there's no way for you to predict where it is inside that 1 kilometer. Suppose you have now learned your lesson that you shouldn't have tried to measure so accurately where the particle is, and so you go in and make a less accurate measurement. You measure where the particle now is to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 4 centimeters, a typical wavelength of light, and you find that it's at this location. And then you want to go in and predict where the particle is going to be 1 second later. You can't once again because the particle has turned into a quantum fuzzball and is now spread over a size of about 10 centimeters. This uncertainty relation basically says the more accurately you measure where the particle is, the more uncertain its speed becomes, and you just can't predict where it's going to be at the time of the next measurement. That's not the way things occur for ordinary macroscopic objects like you and me, or so people have normally thought. But I would like to speculate now that in the early 21st century, we will begin to see macroscopic objects the size of you and me behave quantum mechanically. Not because the laws of physics have changed in the 21st century, but because our ability to make high-precision measurements has continued to improve. And that a new technology will be created to deal with this quantum mechanical behavior, this technology called quantum non-demolition technology, which is going to involve our having to manipulate the wave functions of these macroscopic objects in the process of measuring what they are doing in order to prevent the uncertainty principle from getting in the way of what the measurements we're trying to make. This is a very informed speculation because we need quantum non-demolition technology for LIGO, for this gravitational wave detection project. Consider one of these mirrors here. It weighs 11 kilograms. Light is going back and forth off of it. This is a human being standing beside that vacuum tube. It's a large vacuum tube. In fact, it has a number of laser beams going back and forth that are used in the monitoring of these test mass or mirror motions. These 11 kilogram centimeter or 11 kilogram object motions. Let's look at how the accuracy of measurement of these mirrors, these 11 kilogram objects, is developing. Now, the laser beams that are used in LIGO to monitor these mirrors, they feel the average position of all of the atoms in the mirror. They feel what is called the center of mass degree of freedom of that mirror, just the, where is the location of the center of mass. They actually average over a time of about a hundredth of a second in making their measurement. So they say, averaged over a time of a hundredth of a second, where is the center of mass of this mirror? In the period 2004 to 2006, after the first enhancements, the first improvements of the detectors that our team is now building in those vacuum systems, we expect to be monitoring the motions of the center of mass of these mirrors to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. It's an improvement of a factor of 10 over the initial accuracies. You then ask for an 11 kilogram mirror. What happens if you determine where the center of mass is to a precision of 10 to the minus 17 centimeters? You wait a hundredth of a second, then you want to make a second measurement to see whether a gravity wave has pushed the mirror back and forth. Well, in that hundredth of a second, the mirror will exhibit, the center of mass of the mirror will exhibit fuzzball behavior, and you can't predict where it is because it will have spread out by about a factor of 2 to 2 times 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. In other words, we expect in 2004-2005 to be seeing an 11 kilogram object behaving in a quantum mechanical manner. And thereafter, in 2008, when we hope to be operating at a factor of 10 better accuracy than that, and we make measurements at 10 to the minus 18 centimeters, the fuzzball behavior of our 11 kilogram object will make its center of mass become, after a hundredth of a second, uncertain by the level of 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. We're in bad trouble. How the heck can we see whether a gravity wave did this or whether quantum mechanics did this? And so we have to learn how to redesign our instruments so that we will be able, in fact, to learn the influence of a gravity wave at a 10 to the minus 18 centimeter accuracy in the presence of this 10 to the minus 16 centimeter fuzzball behavior. And that's the nature of QND technology. And that, in fact, is the principal effort that's going on in my own research group at the present time in collaboration with a Russian research group led by Vladimir Braginsky. We have some potential designs that I'll be discussing at a conference tomorrow for the birthday of Jim Hartle, a longtime friend and collaborator of mine. We have ways to do this, but we don't yet have fully satisfactory ways. But it is coming, and it's coming, interestingly, because of the challenge of trying to detect gravitational waves in order to measure the warpage of space and time of black holes. So you sort of see how something that's extremely esoteric can lead to, on one hand, trying to study warpage of space-time in the distant universe, can lead to the development of high-precision technology that, in fact, I expect in the 21st century may become ultimately a fairly common part of high technology, but driven, really, by space-time warpage issues. The last part of the talk, I would like to look toward the future a little more. and talk about singularities at the centers of black holes and the problem of the marriage of the challenge of the marriage of quantum mechanics with general relativity or the laws of quantum gravity. When you last you saw me about 20 minutes ago, I was falling down a black hole toward the singularity. Except you couldn't see me because you were outside the horizon. So I'll just tell you what happens to me as I go down toward the singularity. According to general relativity, as I near this singularity, I will discover that the warpage of space and time is highly oscillatory. As I near the singularity, the warpage of space and time does to me what a gravity wave does to the LIGO test masses. It stretches me, just as it pushes the test masses back and forth, similarly it stretches me from head to foot, stretching my from head to foot and squeezing me from the sides. The next half cycle it stretches me from the sides and squeezes me from head to foot, and the oscillations get stronger and stronger and stronger and faster and faster and faster. And these aren't tiny things that you struggle to build QND, quantum non-demolition technology, to measure. These are things that kill me. And after I'm dead, the warpage of space and time, as my body nears the singularity, starts stretching and squeezing the atoms of which my body is made, pummeling them out of existence, pummeling all forms of matter as we know it out of existence, pummeling space and time as we know it out of existence, at the ultimate singularity at the core of the black hole. And that's the prediction of general relativity, and it's more bizarre than the prediction of black holes. John Wheeler, who was my mentor as when I was a graduate student at Princeton, thought very deeply about the issue of what goes on in singularities and about how the laws of quantum mechanics must then take over and modify the predictions of general relativity, because we are getting then extreme oscillations on very, very tiny length scales, and that must mean that quantum mechanics comes into play. And through a lot of thinking about the nature of quantum mechanics, the nature of space-time curvature, and how they might mesh together, he speculated in the 1950s, a long time ago, that the singularity is going to be a place then in which space and time, as we know them, cease to exist, and they're replaced by a sort of a probabilistic foam called quantum foam, probabilistic foam of space in which space might have very complicated topologies like I've drawn here, but on very short length scales that in terms of formulas are given by the square root of Newton's gravitation constant, which governs space-time warpage, Planck's constant, which governs the laws of quantum mechanics, divided by the speed of light cubed and square root. That's 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That's ever so much smaller than any measurement LIGO can ever hope to make. A 10 to the minus 20 of the diameter of the nucleus of an atom. And at that very tiny length scale, Wheeler speculated there would be a quantum mechanical foam down inside this singularity, and the structure of the singularity would be made up of quantum foam. Really, these singularities, the centers of black holes, are sort of the ultimate laboratory, in fact, for studying the marriage of the laws of general relativity with the laws of quantum mechanics, the unification. And so the very best theory we have, or the beginning of a theory that we have, for these laws of quantum gravity that come out of that marriage is called a string theory, or some variant of string theory, sometimes now called M theory. And there is a very big effort then here at the ITP and elsewhere around the world among the world's foremost theoretical physicists to really try to understand what are the predictions of this new string theory about the marriage of general relativity and quantum mechanics. And I heard a wonderful lecture here a couple of weeks ago given by Joe Polchinski, in which he described how string theory how strings may in fact suppress Wheeler's quantum foam. Here we are nearly 50 years after Wheeler made these speculations. These speculations are still very much at the forefront of people's trying to understand what's going on. There's a great ferment of ideas about what goes on in the marriage of general relativity with quantum mechanics. Quantum foam is one of the ideas. Jim Hartle, whose birthday we are here, as many of us, to celebrate, has done a lot of work with Stephen Hawking in thinking about quantum foam and how you'd build quantum gravity and theories of the beginning of the universe that may involve these kinds of ideas. The string theorists are trying to get rid of these ideas, and as I say, it's a great intellectual ferment. Is there any hope ever to do experimental studies of singularities to test the laws of quantum gravity, since they really are the ultimate crucible at which the quantum laws of quantum gravity would come together, or an ultimate crucible? Well, as a certain bumper sticker that I see from time to time says, the Big Bang is a naked singularity. That is, the universe was began, we believe, in a singularity. It exploded out of the singularity like a surface of a balloon, produced in that singularity, along with all of the matter, would have been gravitational waves. And so I show this balloon with little jagged bumps on it, which I think of as the gravitational waves. And LIGO and the other gravitational wave detectors that will be built over the coming decades, one of the things they will try to do is find gravitational waves that were created in the Big Bang singularity and try to figure out what was the nature of the very beginning of the universe through gravitational waves. Now, gravitational waves really are a rather ideal tool for studying the singularity at the beginning of the universe. Because if you look at all of the radiation that's bombarding the Earth coming from the very early universe, well, the only such radiation that people have found thus far are photons, electromagnetic waves. Those electromagnetic waves are seen in the form of microwave radiation, the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation coming off the Big Bang. And they have traveled to us freely since the universe is about 100,000 years old. But before that, the universe was so hot and the material was so dense that electromagnetic waves couldn't propagate. They were trapped in the matter. They were basically emitted and liberated and able to travel only after the universe cooled down to a low enough temperature and expanded to a low enough density for them to propagate. That is, the last 100,000, or since the universe was 100,000 years old. And here we are 10 billion years into the age of the universe today. Well, that's remarkable that electromagnetic astronomers can study way back to when the universe was just 100,000 years old. But if we could detect neutrinos produced in the Big Bang, another fundamental particle like photons, with neutrinos we could study what the universe was like when it was 1 second old, because they are much more penetrating than photons are. And so they were trapped in the matter and only up until the universe was 1 second old, and then they were liberated and can travel to us and tell us about the universe at that point. Of all the forms of radiation there are in the universe, by far the most penetrating is gravitational waves. And they are so penetrating that, according to our understanding of them, they should never have been trapped in the matter. They should have traveled freely to us from the Big Bang singularity, except for interacting with the background warpage of space and time of the universe as a whole, that they would not have been trapped by matter. And so with gravitational waves, we actually have hope of being able to study the earliest moments of the universe and perhaps get some insight experimentally into the marriage between general relativity and the laws of quantum mechanics. That's, however, not all that satisfying. It would be much nicer if we could find and study singularities in the present-day universe. Is there any hope to do so, to have one in the laboratory as an experimental object for studying the laws of quantum gravity? Well, the establishment's answer to this, the physics establishment's answer to this, is probably not, or more commonly a resounding no. This is Roger Penrose's cosmic censorship conjecture, It's a conjecture firmly believed by the establishment in our field that all singularities except the Big Bang are inside black holes. That is, they are clothed by horizons hidden from the external universe, and the only way you can ever explore them is by giving up the right to publish. Well, I am somebody who likes to tweak the establishment on occasion, and Stephen Hawking is sort of the epitome of the establishment. And so some years ago, Stephen Hawking, John Preskill, and I, John is a colleague of mine at Caltech, made a bet. Whereas Stephen Hawking firmly believes that naked singularities, the kind that we could have here in the laboratory and study experimentally, are an anathema and should be prohibited by the laws of classical physics, and whereas Preskill and Thorne regard naked singularities as quantum gravitational objects that might exist unclothed by horizons for all the universe to see, therefore Hawking offers, and Preskill and Thorne accept, a wager. And then there's a bunch of gobbledygook here designed to protect Stephen Hawking's side of the bet. And the bottom line is that Hawking wagers that the result that you simply cannot make a naked singularity in the universe. And we claim that you could. The loser will reward the winner with clothing to cover the winner's nakedness. The clothing is to be embroidered with a suitable concessionary message. 24 September 1991. Well, Hawking has conceded. And it made the front page of the New York Times. With Hawking's picture, John Preskill's picture, and my picture, but not a word on the front page of the New York Times about the person who forced him to concede by making the scientific discovery. Only the guys who made the bet. So, if you want to get famous, make bets with Stephen Hawking. That's a better way to get famous. Pardon? It was Chepchewick. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to talk about that. So, why did Hawking concede? He conceded because of work done in solving Einstein's equations on supercomputers. In numerical relativity, the same kinds of enterprises is going to be a key to the future of gravitational wave astronomy in comparing the predictions of the theory with the observations of LIGO. He conceded because of supercomputer calculations carried out by Matthew Chopchewick, who is here at the ITP at the present time in connection with one of these programs that's going on. And then subsequent simulations by a number of other people, particularly Andrew Abrahams and Charles Evans, and then some accompanying pencil and paper calculations by Demetrios Christodoulou, a mathematician at Princeton University. What Chopchewick did was he took some waves, which in his case were idealized things called scalar waves. I focused on Abrahams and Evans because after Chopchewick's discovery, they did this with gravitational waves. And so let me talk about the gravitational wave case. So you take gravitational waves on a supercomputer and you set them imploding toward a sender from all directions. And so you have a sender down here and you send these waves in from all directions. We don't have the technology to generate gravitational waves and focus them down like that. I mean, there's technology to generate laser beams and focus them down to try to do controlled fusion, and this is very much like that kind of technology that's being pursued at Livermore. You imagine doing this then on a supercomputer, solving Einstein's equations of general relativity to very high precision. And what Chopchewick discovered was that as these waves come in, they get stronger and stronger, and if you carefully design the strength of the waves to begin with, you can make these waves come in, interact with themselves, and the whole structure of space and time begins to boil and froth. And you start building up shorter and shorter wavelength structures in the curvature of space-time. You have then shorter and shorter wavelength gravitational waves coming out. And this boiling froth in here shrinks smaller and smaller, radiating away most of the energy that was in those gravitational waves, but ultimately creates right at the center an arbitrarily large strength of warpage, But in an infinitesimally small region of space with an infinitesimally small total amount of energy and it lasts an infinitesimal duration of time. But nevertheless, it is a naked singularity, and Hawking had to concede. And it was quite a surprise, I think, to people that the laws of physics permitted this. This does not mean that you can get massive, long-lived naked singularities. They are a long shot, but they are possible. They're an unlikely possibility. But in fact, even things that are unlikely possibilities are things that we ought to search for if we have the right tools. Gravitational waves are such tools. And so, in fact, we expect over the coming decade or two to do searches for naked singularities by mapping the space-time warpage of a central body when, say, a small black hole orbits around it and spirals into it. And if, when we do that mapping, we discover that that space-time warpage is not the warpage of a black hole, we may find, in fact, that it is a warpage of a naked singularity. So the same techniques as we are planning to use to map the warpage of space-time around black holes, we can search for other kinds of exotic central bodies, such as naked singularities. Well, let me just wind up with one last transparency. I have indicated that the laws of quantum gravity really are the holy grail of theoretical physics these days, and I'd like to make some speculations about those laws of quantum gravity. I should make maybe two remarks before I talk about my speculations. First remark is that I don't really work seriously in this subject myself. I have been tied up in trying to make LIGO work, working both on the theory of sources and on development of ideas for the technology. But ITP is just, it has a number of the world's very best experts on this, and so with a little bit of trepidation in front of David Gross and his colleagues, I'm going to make some speculations. My second remark before I discuss the speculations is a product label warning. Kip Thorne is regarded by many as a starry-eyed optimist. Having said that, let me speculate. Physicists will understand the laws of quantum gravity fully before I die. I intend to live to 110. My grandparents lived into their mid-90s. I have a good shot at that. But in fact, the current pace of progress in the string theory approach to quantum gravity, it's very believable that these laws would be fully understandable in the next decade or so. And so it's coming fast at the present time. We don't know whether there's a brick wall between here and there or not, but it's coming fast at the present time. And I'm really quite convinced surely by the time I die they'll be understood, and probably far before then. When we do understand them, they will answer the following questions. How did our universe come into being? This is the subject of quantum cosmology, in which Jim Hartle is the world's best expert. Are there other universes besides our own? Can the quantum foam at the center of a black hole create new universes? Is it possible to construct machines for traveling backward in time? I strongly suspect that all of these and many more fundamental questions will be answered by the laws of quantum gravity, and they will surely generate a 21st century revolution in our understanding of the nature of the universe that I believe is likely to rival the revolutions that we saw in the 20th century. Thank you. Yes, 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 no. They would be very speculative. I feel moderately confident in these speculations, but I don't know what the answers are.
But yes, 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 no.
That's totally total speculation. Yeah.
So we have time for some questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those streams
coming out of the black hole of central axis. Was that material coming out of the black hole, or was that just the effects on space?
What we believe is going on there is something called the Blandford-Znaik effect, which is named for the people who first discovered it in the laws of physics, Roger Blandford and Roman Znaik. And what we think is going on is that you have this disk of hot gas around the black hole that has magnetic fields in it, like the Earth's magnetic field. As the gas gradually is pushed onto the black hole, pulled onto the black hole, the gas carries the magnetic field with it. And you wind up with magnetic fields then threading through the hole. The gas goes into the hole and can never come out. But the magnetic fields go down and stick into the hole, not carrying information out of the hole at all. They're just sort of sticking into it like strings. No information can climb out of the hole along those fields, but the fields stick through the hole. As the hole spins, it drags the fields into a spinning motion along with the hole, and that spinning motion of these magnetic fields creates extremely intense electrical fields. This is a standard way to generate electric power, is by spinning magnetic fields. In fact, generates electric fields that are so strong that you can have a voltage drop between the north pole of the black hole and the equator, according to Blandford and Znaik's analyses, as large as 10 to the 20th volts. Those electric fields are so strong that they break the vacuum. They create electron-positron pairs around a black hole by their very great intensity. And so they basically pull particles and antiparticles out of the vacuum, creating them, using ultimately the black hole spin energy to do this. But the spin energy goes into spinning the magnetic field. The magnetic field then, as it spins, creates the electric field. The electric field pulls apart the vacuum and creates particles and antiparticles. And these jets then are made of the magnetic field and these created particles and antiparticles and other matter that gets entrained as they flow out. And so some of these this material goes down the hole, and some of this material goes flying off into space along the jets. And so there's a very elegant and I think rather convincing theory of these jets that's based on that kind of an idea. In some cases, you can also get these jets formed through magnetic fields that are attached to the disk itself. But the cleanest jets will be the jets that are produced by the magnetic fields that thread the black hole. So that sort of illustrates, in fact, the rich kinds of role that a black hole may play in the astrophysical universe. We have lots of observational evidence of that kind of behavior. What we don't have, however, as yet, is maps of the space-time warpage, and that's what we're going after with the gravitational waves.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
By using the small black holes around the large one, are you anticipating reading information or inferring information from beyond the horizon?
No. Once the small black hole has merged with the large black hole, gone down the horizon, we get no more information out. So we should, it has been shown by a graduate student of mine, Fenton Ryan, mathematically, that the waves do carry off a complete map encoded in them of the space-time warpage around a black hole that we can, if we have clean enough instruments that with a low enough noise, we can decode and pull out a lot of the details of the map. But it's a map only of the region above the horizon and not of the region below the horizon. I might mention that Fenton Ryan, who's a superb physicist, upon completing his PhD, he went to Wall Street. And not because he had to, but because he saw a greater intellectual challenge in predicting how markets behave than in studying space-time warpage, which are beyond the horizon.
Second question, if I may. Is there a practical problem in physically positioning the 11 kilogram masses at each end of the LIGO leg so that they're at the right space?
Yeah, is there a practical problem physically positioning these masses so they're at the right phase location? The answer is yes, because what the way this really operates is you have each of these masses with a very high reflectivity mirror on its inside, and you're trying to trap the laser light between those two mirrors and operate what this system is what's called an optical cavity. So you so there are certain separations at which this instrument will operate and others at which it will not. And basically, every one-half wavelength of light, there is a location where it will operate, but that location is something like a thousandth of a wavelength of light long. So you have to position it to something like a thousandth of a wavelength of light in one of these little grooves. And so a significant piece of the development of the technology has been the development of techniques optically by looking at the laser light to tell where you are relative to the right position and to apply forces that drive you into the right position automatically without human intervention. That's called locking the interferometer. And that issue has been the subject of several PhD theses and has been involved considerable experimental developmental work, but it's just one of a large number of issues that have had to be confronted by the experimenters in designing, building, and making these instruments work. So did the laser light push the edge of the mirror and affect the precision of the measurement? Yes, that's a very good question. There are two aspects to that pushing of the mirror. The laser light is almost completely steady. And so it just pushes the mirror out, so instead of hanging precisely vertically, it hangs at an angle, so that the tension in the wire makes up for this pressure. But then the real killer is that the light fluctuates. And in fact, it is the fluctuations in the light pressure that, from one point of view, are responsible for the fuzzball behavior, the quantum fuzzball behavior of these test masses. That is, the more accurately you want to measure where this mirror is, the higher the light power you have to use, and that means the larger the fluctuating pressure is, light pressure is. And those fluctuations of light pressure then buffet the mirror and cause it to shake in a totally unpredictable manner. What's going on here is the quantum mechanical properties of the light, which show up in this fluctuating light pressure, are reinforcing the quantum mechanical properties of the test mass that shows up in the fuzzball behavior. And so the two are intimately connected. In our efforts to design quantum non-demolition technology, we have to understand thoroughly the relationship between these and understand how to unravel them and make use of, manipulate both phenomena, the intrinsic fuzzball behavior of these mirrors and the fuzzball light behavior induced by the fluctuating light pressure.
Yeah. Are this gamma ray bursts thought to be two black holes subsume themselves, and is there any thought about how that creates that energy?
Are the gamma ray bursts thought to be two black holes subsuming themselves? There have been speculations that that might be the case, but those speculations have not really been awfully successful. If what you have is just two black holes and no matter around, you've got a problem, because gamma ray bursts or gamma rays are electromagnetic radiation, and they are produced only by charged particles. And so you've got to get charged particles. And so if it's two black holes, you have to have a mechanism to get charged particles. Roger Blanford, whom I mentioned to you before, has speculated, but these speculations have not reached complete fruition, that you could have two black holes that orbit around each other, spiraling together, and they entrain a magnetic field that might come from interstellar space. And the magnetic field gets wound up with the black holes as they spiral together and as they're spinning. And then, as it gets wound up, you get intense electric fields, you get the breaking of the vacuum, you get particle-antiparticle pair production, and you may get gamma ray bursts. That is not, as I say, that kind of an idea has not been worked out far enough to become convincing that that's right. And I think that most people at the present time, including Roger, I believe, think that what is going on is that you have either a star that could be a neutron star or possibly a white dwarf in a model Roger's currently working on that gets torn apart by a black hole as it nears the black hole, and the tearing apart of the star initiates the triggering of the gamma ray burst. It could also be two neutron stars that come together, smash together, and initiate the gamma ray burst. But at the present time, I gather that sort of the best of a bunch of bad theories is that you have a star being torn apart by a black hole initiating the burst.
What have you got? Is there a particle which is transmitted neutrinos and photons?
Is there a particle associated with these gravitational waves? Just as there is a photon as the particle associated with electromagnetic waves. The laws of quantum gravity tell us, and we know enough about the laws of quantum gravity to be able to discuss this with complete confidence. We don't know them well enough to discuss what goes on in singularities with complete confidence. The laws of quantum gravity tell us that gravitational waves must have an associated particle called the graviton. We also know that if you have huge numbers of such particles, gravitons in this case, all moving in the same manner, or in technical language, all in the same quantum state, then they behave like a very classical wave, not like particles at all. So for electromagnetic waves, if you just have a few high-energy photons, they behave like particles, but if you have huge numbers of them, of lower energy photons, where it's easier to get huge numbers of them, they behave like a wave. Well, gravitational waves are extremely classical because you have, for the waves that we expect to see from colliding black holes, we have enormous numbers of gravitons all in the same quantum state, all doing the same thing, carrying this wave. Enormous means, in this case, in one quantum state, a number like 10 to the 70 gravitons, 10 to the 70 gravitons. And that means that quantum mechanical effects will be there, and if we had good enough technology, we could see them. But they will show up in little fluctuations, unpredictable fluctuations of the gravitational waves at the level of one part in the square root of 10 to the 70, one part in 10 to the 35. And that's not technology that I expect to see in my lifetime.
Yeah, have you considered that the path of light along a space-time warp might really be something more like a refractive index effect?
So if we consider the possibility that the path of light through space-time warpage might be like refractive index effect associated with a change of the speed of light. In the standard way of writing down the laws of general relativity, that is not the case. However, you can reformulate the laws in a form that is mathematically equivalent, but it carries a different set of words, different set of pictures with it. And when you do this reformulation of the laws, you in fact do have a slowing down of light in the vicinity of a gravitating body, and it does behave very much like a medium with an index of refraction. And this is quite true quite generally. The laws of physics, once you understand them deeply, you can typically find a number of different ways to transform them mathematically, so that you get precisely the same predictions for the outcome of any measurement that you make. And yet, they look different. They are described in terms of different kinds of pictures and different kinds of words. But still, the predictions of the results of experiments are the same. And a very good physicist learns to think about the laws from a number of different points of view, because a particular problem may be better solved in general relativity by taking the conventional point of view where it's just space-time warpage and light propagates at the unique speed of 3 times 10 to the 5th kilometers per second, 300,000 kilometers per second everywhere. But another problem may be better solved by thinking of not space-time warpage, but rather a behavior like an index of refraction that slows light down. And so we learn to go back and forth between these different paradigms. But when we talk with people who are not working in our field, by gentleman's agreement, we usually sweep this under the rug and say, space-time is warped, period.
I'm having a hard time understanding how a naked singularity could have no event horizon, no horizon, unless
well,
it's massive.
So is Hawking. you're in good company.
Explain it to me. How is it possible?
You can write down solutions. You can find solutions of Einstein's equations that describe naked singularities. It's easy. Once you know the mathematics of general relativity, you can find these solutions. When you explore their properties, you find that they are typically very anisotropic beasts. They look different when you come at them from different directions. So if you come in from this direction, they may pull on you. When you come in from that direction, they at first pull on you, but as you get in closer, they may repel gravitationally. And coming in from this direction, they may look like they're opening up into another universe. Coming in from this direction, they may seem to be pinching down. They just have weird behaviors of the geometry of space that are so different from just a simple gravitational pull that it's hard to imagine. But you see it there in the mathematics. The fact that we have solutions of Einstein's equations that describe these kinds of things does not at all mean that those objects exist. If those objects were to exist, they would either have had to form, say, by the collapse of a star dynamically, or they would have had to have been created in the Big Bang, one or the other. And so the issue is whether they can be formed. We have strong evidence, but not completely firm evidence, that whenever any object collapses, implodes, it forms a black hole, that you don't form naked singularities. This is what Preskill and I have challenged, that you might form naked singularities. The establishment's view is that it will probably turn out, when we understand the laws more deeply, that there's no way to form these. If they could form and could exist, we also can't predict how long they would live, how they would behave, because they're governed by the laws of quantum gravity. Until David and his friends give us those laws of quantum gravity and understand them fully, we can't really predict what they would do. But we can say, here is a solution to Einstein's equations. It fails when you get right down to the singularity, but it has this kind of space-time warpage in the vicinity, and this solution of Einstein's equations has no horizon. Then Hawking, seeing such a solution, will say, there's no way to form it. And he may well be right, but... These things could have very large masses. They could pull strongly on objects gravitationally that are far away. You can write down solutions that have that property. They're not quite like anything else that people generally talk about in terms of physics. And they very likely don't exist, but the odds of their being able to exist are high enough that I'm willing to bet. I mean, I've won all my bets with Hawking so far. So I'm willing to go out on a limb a little bit.
Okay, well, please join us all for refreshments, and you're free to get some water.